From 9 to 5 Mac, this is Tech Trace, the show where we talk about Apple news and rumors from a developer's perspective. And joining me as always is my good friend, John Sandell. How are you doing, John?
I'm doing great. I am prepared for summer. I am not super prepared for WWDC, but more on that later. But it's busy times, good stuff. And what about you, Rambo?
No one is prepared for WWDC.
It's no way to get prepared, especially this year. I feel like it has the potential for being a really big one, and it's kind of hard to know what to expect.
That's true, and I bet even Apple is not prepared for WWDC as
right.
much as they would like to be.
Exactly. No sleep until WWDC, right? That's the classic thing. I am sleeping, though. You know, we've talked about this, right? Like, I wouldn't cut sleep. That's the last thing I would ever cut, but I do have a lot of things I want to get done, but I want to tell you more about that later. But first, I want to hear, how are you?
I am great. I've been doing some Chibi Studio work again, back, because I've been traveling a lot, so I didn't have much time. Just doing last minute things before I can start a public beta, and I'm having lots of fun, as you've seen, with doing this, we call it the Learn tab in the app, where you can see like little tutorials and content that we produce, kind of like the Today tab in the App Store, but
yeah.
Simpler, of course. So I had lots of fun implementing that yesterday, and it was going to be more complicated, but when I started working on it, at least the backend part ended up being, again, just a JSON file on a CDN.
That's how it all turns out, right? Yeah. Apps are just pretty pictures of JSON, right? That's how it all turns out in the end.
And I can transition to a more complicated thing if I want to in the future. It's just like change the URL or something. But I'm happy with how it is right now. You've seen the cool video within the notification thing I made. So we have these tutorials that are video tutorials the user can access in the Learn tab. And when we publish a new one, we can send a notification, and it actually plays the video within the notification, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, that's very cool. It seems like there are so many rich things you can do with these. Well, they're called rich notifications, right? For
yeah.
It's a good name. There seems to be so many things you can do with them, and yet I don't see too many apps taking advantage of them. So could you just tell us a little bit, like, what goes into building something like that? Like, is it complicated? What kind of options do you have at your disposal? Because as far as I know, you can just present a view controller there, right?
Yes, and I'm not even going to that level yet. You have two types of notification extensions. One of them is the notification service extension, and the other one is the notification content extension. So with the notification service extension, which is the one I am working with, you can customize the content of a notification after it's arrived.
Right.
So you can have, say, a key on your notification payload that's a URL to a video file. And then in this extension, you take that URL, you download it, and you set it as a property on the notification thing. You call a completion handler, and boom, it plays your video in the notification. And you can do the same for pictures, audio, and even GIFs if you want to. So it's very flexible and super easy to implement. Like I told you, the entire notification service for Chibi Studio at the moment is less than 200 lines of code, and it handles three different types of notifications, all of them with like API calls to servers and super rich content. But the notification service itself is super simple.
Nice. It sounds very similar to when you're building a share extension, where you are essentially injecting a bit of middleware, if you will, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the notification comes in, your middleware, your extension gets called, you decide what to do with it, then you call a completion handler once you've finished your operations, and then the notification gets presented to the user.
It's kind of like a function. It gives you a notification content, and you return the notification content, possibly with some changes to it.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, it's very nice.
Beautiful.
And if you want to go further, you can completely customize the look of the notification content by implementing a notification content extension. And then you can, it's just a view controller. You can do anything you want. And since iOS 12, it can even contain interactive controls like buttons, switches, and stuff like that. So yeah, there's a lot of power to be had with notifications, and that it's, they are definitely not taken full advantage of by most apps. And it's, I'm not sure why, because it's actually quite simple to implement and very low maintenance.
I think a big reason could be kind of what we've touched on before on the show, is a little bit the way that you need to architect your iOS app these days in order to support all these features is very different from how it used to be, you know? Since back in the day when iOS first came out and the SDK was launched, everything centered around the infamous app delegate, right? And we've talked about it before, how many things still go through the app delegate, especially when it comes to like making decisions around notifications, for example, if you don't have that extension and other things as well. But there are so many extensions now that you can implement. And in order to take full advantage of those, you really need to build your app in a much, much more modular fashion where, you know, some apps, even like apps like Messages, you can use pretty much the full app from within a notification. And only possible if you have built that UI, like that view controller, that part of the app, as a completely separate thing that isn't really tied into your UI application lifecycle.
Yeah, that's true. And I actually import, I think, 3 different frameworks in my notification service extension. All my frameworks that. One of them is like the data layer. The other one is like this foundation framework with models. And the other one is the one that talks to my server. So yeah, I've built the app from the ground up with this modularity in mind. So yes, if you have an app that's not like that, it is a little bit more work. But you don't have to go all in. You can just, you can start by just copying files over, like just adding them to the notification targets and refactor later if you want to. But if it's like, if you need like just this one class or something, then maybe you don't even need to modularize that much. But yeah, I wish developers were more happy using these types of extensions. And I actually have a talk about that that I haven't given in English yet, just in Portuguese. But I plan on giving it again.
Yeah, looking forward to it. And I'm looking forward to animating it.
So, John, what have you been doing?
So, like I mentioned, I am right now in full getting ready for WWDC mode. And what that means for me this year is that I'm building this dedicated site for all of my WWDC content. And I mentioned it, I think, on the previous episode, or maybe the one before that. But I am going big this year in terms of WWDC. I want to create a lot of content, and I want to try to summarize the conference and give a lot of, you know, insights and recommendations of what videos to watch and these kind of things during the event. So there's going to be a dedicated site. There's going to be multiple pieces of content released every day. It's going to be more like short bursts of content. So not so many like long form articles, but more like, here's a cool video to watch. Here's an interview with a developer, what they think. Here's maybe a podcast. There's going to be like a lot of different things going on. So right now, I am both building out like the infrastructure in order to host this specific site, and I'm using it as a battle test for my static site generator as well. So it all's kind of a perfect storm coming together here. So I'm working on finishing that, and I'm working on like planning for all the content, you know, preparing some stuff. And it's a lot of work, but I think the end result is going to be worth it. And I think it's going to be a lot of fun to do this, because it's going to give me also like a bit of a different way of experiencing WWDC. Even if I'm not going to be there, just like watching all this content and all the videos and talking to people who are going to be there, it's going to be very different since I'm going to produce all of this content during the week. So I'm really excited about this, and hopefully I can tell you even more about this and what the exact plans will be and what the exact concept will be next week or the week after as I'm kind of finalizing it right now.
Awesome. Can't wait to see that. I'm sure it's going to be awesome.
Yeah, I hope so. And I reached a big milestone also with my static site generator as Those who have listened to the show for a while know that I've been working for a while since pretty much the beginning of the year on a pure Swift static site generator. And it has a lot of different parts. I wanted to build it in a very modular fashion so that people can use either just one part of it, or they could reuse like a building block from it in another context. And I just hit a big milestone where I finished one of the tools that is part of this like static site generator tool chain. And this tool is called Plot, and it's basically a tool for indexing Markdown content. So you give it a folder with your articles or your content, your images or videos, whatever it is you have, and this tool will go through those folders, it will index it, it will check the tags, it will build up a map, like a content map, which later it will then give to the actual site generator in order to run that through a series of templates. So that's a pretty big milestone. It's been tricky to get the API right, and in order to have a really nice API that you could use as a standalone thing, but also as part of the static site generation tool chain. So it's been a fun challenge. I've learned a lot, and yeah, I'm excited about it.
Awesome. I want to potentially derail this conversation, but okay, I need to ask you a question. Most of your projects, if not all of them, in my opinion, have really cool names. Where do they come from? What's the process like for naming a Sundell project?
That's a great question, and thanks for saying that. I do spend maybe more time than I should on the actual naming. And, you know, this is funny because I used to be terrible at naming. You can just see my website, which is just Swift by Sundell, because, you know, that's my last name. It has kind of grown on me, this name, but still, like, I've been very, in the past, very basic with my naming, but now I've gotten a little bit more creative. And so my process is actually that I start with what I think the verb is that I'm trying to do. So in the case of plot, for example, so plot can mean two things, right? It can be a plot for a movie, like a story, or it can be like that you're plotting something, you are, you know, measuring it, and you are making a plan for something. So many words can mean many different things, and I really like to find some kind of synonym or related verb to what I'm trying to do. So in this case, I am creating a map of content. Okay, so that's a map. What can I do? Can I do like... I had originally thinking around the different terms around mapping. So will it be called mapper? Will it be called, cartographer or something, you know? But then you start getting more complicated, and I wanted something really simple. So then I often go to like to a dictionary, and I look at different synonyms, and I just try to find a verb or a noun or some word that I really like and that also like has a hint of what it is that it actually does. So I don't like these kind of names where it's called like Dragonfire, you know, or something like that has nothing to do with what it's trying to do. So I really like something that sounds cool, it's simple, it's short, but also it's related to what it's doing. So that's kind of my vague process. But it does involve a lot of just like browsing through dictionaries and trying to find a perfect word for what I'm trying to do.
Yeah, that's a good process, and it's very similar to what I do. I'm always picking a starter words or a couple and looking at a dictionary for synonyms and seeing what sounds good. And sometimes you'll find a word you didn't even know existed, but that sounds cool, and you'll end up using that.
Yeah, exactly. And one of my recent projects is called Sweep, and it was very similar there. Like, so this is a string scanning library. So what do I name that? Do I name it Scanner? Originally it was called Scan, actually. But then I thought like Scan, you know, it makes it sound like it's some kind of image library, right? Or some kind of like QR code scanner. And I also I want to try to avoid this kind of ambiguity when it comes to naming. I want to either it be so abstract that you need to check out what it actually is, or something that is obvious what it is that it does. So in the case of Sweep, it's definitely not obvious that it's a string scanner, but, you know, it's again related to what I'm doing, that I'm sweeping through a string, right? So yeah, try to find names that kind of fit those characteristics.
Cool.
All right, so on this episode, we have a bunch of different things that we want to talk about, and the first thing we want to do is a bit of a stack trace first. So you know how we like to review products on the show, you know, specifically Apple products like iPhones and Apple Watches and things like that. But we only ever review them like 1 year after they were released, which is kind of funny because that's usually how long it takes for me to get them, just because I'm always pondering, should I get it, shouldn't I? But this time, we've both been fairly quick in getting the new AirPods. So we want to do an AirPods 2 review, a shocking 1 month after it was released, right? It's just a month, right?
Yeah, about that.
So it's a Stack Trace record.
Definitely.
So, AirPods 2, first thoughts, Rambo, you received these a few days ago, and have you been using them a lot? Like, what's your first impressions of the new AirPods?
Yeah, so the first thing that I noticed, that it's kind of silly, but I know people like this stuff, is that they sound different, not the actual sound of the AirPods when you're listening to stuff, but the sound of the case closing is different, and the sound of when you put an AirPod into the case is also different. Did you notice that, John?
Yeah, I did. It's less of a clicky sound. It's more a little bit more muted, at least in my opinion.
It sounds to me more like a better product, like more premium.
Yeah, exactly. More like well-rounded sound, right?
Yeah. We can compare here really quickly. This is the old AirPods, the case. It sounds like a click.
Yeah.
And this is the other one.
Yeah,
so it's
exactly.
It's a little bit lower pitch sound.
It is, exactly. Not as sharp. Yeah. I feel like, you know, how people can analyze wines and whiskey and these kind of things, you know, or chocolate. I feel like you could have a similar thing for Apple products, where you are an Apple product, you know, analyzer who is analyzing the sounds.
AirPod sommelier.
Exactly. Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I do agree.
Yeah, so it sounds different, and I kind of like that it sounds a little bit different. And there's one thing about sound, and now I'm actually talking about the sound of the earpod AirPods. Well, yeah, I'm gonna call them EarPods, AirPower, everything. So
AirPower.
Just keep that in mind.
Never give up.
Yeah. So some people were saying, oh, they sound better than the old ones. But that's not actually true. And I can confirm that because I had been using a fairly new AirPods from the first generation, and they sound different when they are new because, and this is kind of gross, I'm sorry, because they're not full of earwax.
Right.
Basically, that's it. That's why your new AirPods sound better or different than the old ones. It's because they're completely clean.
Yeah.
So sound is the same. There's the Hey Dingus feature. Have you been using that, John?
I've been using it a lot, and I am really surprised by just how good it is. And it's kind of a little bit jarring in the beginning because you don't get that confirmation that you usually get from Miss Dingus when you say the trigger phrase and you get this ding, you know, that I'm listening now, go ahead, give me a command. But with the new AirPods, you just say the phrase and you don't get any confirmation, but you can just keep talking and Siri will pick all of that up. And that is both really impressive, but it's a really different way of using Siri that I'm still kind of getting used to.
Yeah, I haven't been using it that much, mainly because I use Siri mostly on my Apple Watch by just raising my wrist, or I use it in the HomePod. So I actually just tested it, and yeah, it works very well, but it's not like the way I usually use Siri, so I'm probably not going to be using it that much.
But it is pretty cool to just be out on a walk and you just start talking to Siri. Like, you don't have to wait. You don't have to wait for some confirmation, like I mentioned. And there is very little latency in that experience where you just say the thing and then it's like, yep, okay, I'll remind you about that. Or yeah, I created a note or whatever it is that you want to do. And like I said, I'm still kind of getting used to it, but in general, I really prefer it to be that way. And it makes for a more natural interaction with Siri, I feel like.
Yes, that's true. It's like ubiquitous Siri, like you have it all the time.
Siri is everywhere, always listening. Hiding in the bushes as you're walking.
Yeah, so I'm not going to be using it that much, but I can see why it can be very useful if you like are walking with your Series 4 Apple Watch using the LTE connection. That can be really cool to just be able to talk to Siri at any time. That's super cool.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I'm doing. So, like I mentioned on some previous episodes, my way of using the Apple Watch is mostly now that I go out on walks with my dog, I go out for runs, and it's all just with the Apple Watch. And I'm trying to get as many things done as I can. I mean, I'm still just like relaxing when I'm walking, so I'm not like in full work mode. But, you know, when I'm out walking, I get that oxygen injection in my brain. I start getting lots of ideas and I want to, you know, write them down so I don't have to constantly think about them while I'm walking. And this is great for that because I can just utter it out into the air. And if I'm around some people, they probably think I'm a maniac, but it's all worth it because I can capture my ideas super quickly. And just this feature alone is honestly like almost like worth the upgrade for me. Like if that was the only new thing, I would still be happy with this product, but there are many more things, which I'm also excited about.
Yes, so wireless charging. I wasn't expecting to like it as much as I did, because I have a couple of wireless chargers around the place, and it is very convenient to be able to just drop the case on top of one of them, and that's it. So, yeah, we've talked about how lazy I am here in this show before. And yeah, it's easier to just drop the case on top of a wireless charger than to connect a lightning cable.
Yeah, it's one of those things that sounds so silly when you're talking about it, right? It's like when people talk about having smart lights or any kind of like home automation. It's like, how hard is it to press the light switch? You know, how hard is it to put a lightning cable into your AirPods case? Like, is that really so hard? But for me, like the magic of wireless charging is not that I'm saving a lot of time or anything like that. It's just that It's more like you just drop it on. Like it's this effortless thing where you just have one on your desk, you have one next to where you sleep, or you have one maybe in your living room or something like that, like one of these charging pads. Sadly, not air power, right? But anyway, you just drop it on, boom, and it just starts charging. And for me, it's a great way to just keep all the devices always charged, because you're gonna put it down somewhere anyway. So why not just put it down on a charger?
Yeah, and with this year's iPhones, at least the rumors say, we'll be able to drop it on top of our iPhone and it will charge. That would be kind of cool.
Yeah, that would be cool. I know that the latest Samsung devices have this feature as well, I think, and it's like some kind of new Qi version where it's like, you know, buddy charging, where like one phone can charge another device. I think that could be really cool, especially for those situations where, which has happened to me a lot, which is again why I'm such a fan of wireless charging and just like always having it there on the charger, where I have left the apartment and I'm excited to listen to a podcast and I hear this, you know, this sound in the AirPods.
The saddest sound ever.
The very sad sound. And it would be great in those situations just to be able to like put your phone and your AirPods together for a few minutes and get a little charge.
Yeah, that is true. And but my favorite thing about the new AirPods is how much faster they are at connecting to a device and switching between devices.
Yeah, absolutely. Super fast. Very, very good. And really, again, frictionless, where before, it was always this like awkward thing. Are they connected? Are they not? No. Okay, it didn't work. Let me try again. But now it's just, you switch it, you're done. It just works.
Yeah, that's really, really nice.
And speaking of switching devices, I wanted to hear a little bit if you've had to do some work with AirBuddy, your Mac app, in order to make these new AirPods work with it. Or was it all easy? Or how has this new device kind of affected your development on AirBuddy?
Yeah, in fact, the current shipping version of AirBuddy does not officially support the new AirPods. I'm still to release a big update, which should come fairly soon. But there wasn't too much that changed. The main thing is that they changed a little bit how the assets are managed. So the animation assets for the devices. And the model of the new AirPods it is actually different than what it was supposed to be before. So they were supposed to be AirPods 1.2, and they ended up being 1.3. So there were some assumptions that were not correct. But yeah, I have a beta going on at the moment. If you are an AirBuddy user, you can email airbuddy+beta@rambo.codes, and you can get access to the beta.
That's so, a good email address.
Yeah, but yeah, not many changes. It was fairly easy to have better support for them. If you have the current version of the app, they work. You just don't get the nice animation.
And do you think the increment there in a device number, do you think that's due to AirPower? The fact that they had to make some changes in order to make it like fully Qi compatible instead of being chargeable by AirPower?
I'm not sure. It's possible. It's possible that maybe it was supposed to be a W1 device and ended up being an H1 device later. I'm not sure. It's possible that the assumption was wrong as well. But yeah, I'm not sure what happened there. But it's actually interesting in terms of how different these devices are in terms of software. The first generation AirPods does not run an OS. Like it doesn't have an OS that runs on it. The new one actually runs an OS. It's a very different structure of the firmware that it runs. So it's way more complex in terms of software.
Cool. And by OS, you mean that it can like launch processes, it can manage things, it can do multitasking, where before it was just firmware, like it just did one thing, it was just like one process always running on the device.
I'm not sure about multiple processes because it's a real-time OS. So I'm not sure how that works. But yeah, it's more than just embedded firmware, definitely.
Right, got it.
And by the way, another curiosity that I confirmed is that the AirPods charging case won't communicate wirelessly with anything unless at least one of the AirPods is inside of it. So it doesn't have any wireless communication of its own.
Oh, interesting. So it basically connects to the actual AirPods and uses them as its like antenna?
Yep.
That's really cool. That's very fascinating.
Yeah, because I have a debugging utility for AirBuddy, and I can see in real time the status changes. And once you remove both AirPods from the case, you stop getting the charging status for the case, because it stops transmitting.
Nice. Or not nice, depending on whether you want to connect them with AirBuddy. But yeah, that makes sense. And that's a very clever piece of engineering where it's like, let's try to make this case as light as possible and as, you know, have as much battery as possible. I guess it's the biggest constraint. So it's really cool to see like them actually bridging the case to the AirPods in order to do like communication and radio and networking.
Yeah, another thing that's kind of nice is if you are charging the case and you have at least one of the AirPods inside of it, you will keep transmitting its charging state. If it's not charging and it's closed, it's going to stop transmitting after a very short period to save battery. But if it is charging, it's going to transmit continuously. And I actually plan on taking advantage of that for a feature in AirBuddy, where it will send you a notification when the charging case has completed charging.
Ooh, that's super cool and very useful, because so many times, like I mentioned, I hear that like that sad sound. And what I will do is that I will go back, I will put it on the charger, and I will just wait for a few minutes. And they charge surprisingly fast. And that's true for both these AirPods and the previous generation, where like in 10 minutes, you can get like 50% charge sometimes. It's truly incredible. But it would be very useful, you know, because sometimes while I wait for it to charge, I sit down and check a few emails or check Twitter or something. And to get that notification, say, you're good to go. You can go out and go for your run. That would be great.
You know what I do, right?
What do you do?
I just get another pair of AirPods while the other
of
ones
course,
are charging.
Of course you do. That's easy to do when you live in an Apple product museum or or live in a unofficial Brazilian Apple store. So we have to talk about one more thing, and this is a revelation that I came across during our trip to Italy, where I found out that you, Rambo, you shower using AirPods. You actually wear your AirPods in the shower. And I want to state for the record, we did not shower together. That's not how I found it out. We're not that good friends yet. But I did find out you were telling me that you were showering with AirPods. So how did this happen? Why are you showering with AirPods? Aren't you afraid that they're going to break?
Well, here's the thing. I love listening to podcasts. And of course, I won't like wash my hair with the AirPods on. And of course, I have to take them off to wash my ears. So it's not like a complete experience, showering and podcasting. But they work, and if you don't like run water into them like heavily, just if they only get like a few splashes here and there, they're fine. It's not a problem. So you're listening to podcast and you go, you take a shower and that's it. It's fine.
And the obvious solution to this problem for me would be to listen to podcasts on some kind of speaker, like even your iPhone, like as a speaker, or your iPad, which has great external speakers. Why take the risk of maybe getting more water on them than they can take, and they will maybe electrocute you while you're showering?
Man found dead after AirPods electrocute him in the shower.
And then he swallowed them.
Wow. No. I'm not. Yeah, there's that story as well.
Yeah.
I tried using the iPhone, and I also tried using one of these portable speakers you can have in the bathroom. But there's something about listening to podcasts without having like the voices in my head that I just can't pay attention when I'm not using some sort of headphones or earphones or anything like that. So basically that's the answer. So okay. I am taking the risk.
You are taking the risk. Well, I hope that it's going to be fine, and that both your AirPods and you will be fine. But it was just such a peculiar thing to see you, you know, come out and be like, yeah, of course, I'm showering with AirPods. Doesn't everyone do that?
Yeah. By the way, we don't recommend. So do it at
Don't try this at
risk.
Home. Well, I'm not doing it, so I can say I fully do not recommend this. I'm not even doing it myself. Yeah, shower for me is my one time where I am just by myself. There is no sound. Well, there is sound, but no electronically produced sound, and I'm just collecting my thoughts and relaxing.
That's awesome. Yeah, one time I wanted to have a whiteboard in the shower.
You're turning the shower into your office. Soon you're gonna bring your iPad in there, maybe do some work, you know, maybe publish an article to 9to5Mac, all from the shower. That's gonna be epic. So speaking about reports, our good friend, Mr. Mark Gurman, he's been at it again. He has two new reports on the next iPhone, or what could be the next iPhone, you never know. And his article is about the new chips that are going to presumably be in the next set of iPhones that are about to enter mass production. So Rambo, you want to walk us through what is this all about and what can we learn from this report?
Yeah, so basically what we can learn about this report is that this year's iPhones are well underway. It's interesting. Some of these reports we get every year, and they are kind of like just a confirmation of something everyone already knows. Of course, there's gonna be an A13 processor this year, and of course they're going to be on the new iPhones. But yeah, it's good to know that they are entering production. and they are going to be used presumably for D42, D43, and N104, if I'm remembering correctly, which are the this year's devices.
And the one that is the odd thing out there, the one that is has the leading letter N, what does that mean? Like, what separates those two product lines?
That would be the 10R equivalent, so the quote-unquote low-cost device. So the iPhone XR is N84, and for this year it's going to be N104.
Cool. So it looks like they will continue with the same setup, that there will be a successor to the iPhone XS, and there will be a max version, or, you know, larger version of that, and there will also be a successor to the XR. That's what it looks like, right?
Yeah, I think Mark mentioned D43 and D44. Those are not the models I heard. The models I heard are coming are D42 and D43. So 42 would be the regular size and 43 would be the max. So I'm not sure what's going on with the numbers. Maybe it's some confusion on Mark's part or my part as well. But yeah, as far as I know, it's the D42 and D43. So the regular size and the large size.
If we really, really would like to speculate, we could, of course, revive the good old rumor that there will be a successor to the iPhone SE, right? And maybe that's the final number.
I don't think it would start with a D.
Right, because that's the 10 family, right? The ones that have the notch and the OLED screen and all that stuff.
Yeah, the D is basically OLED, is what defines the D prefix.
Right, got it.
But those numbers not always make sense, so they could do whatever they want.
Yeah, and a successor to the iPhone SE, like, now I'm really pulling a thread here. We don't really have any concrete evidence of that, but people have been dreaming and hoping, right? And presumably, like, a successor to the iPhone SE would perhaps use OLED screens, right? And would kind of be a shrunken down version of the 10 form factor, because it seems very clearly that that's where we're going with iPhones in general, is that, you know, home buttons are going away. We're going to have as edge-to-edge screens as possible. There's still going to be a notch probably for a few generations. So it would make sense if there will be an iPhone SE that I would follow the same aesthetics, right?
Yes, it would, but that's not what the SE is, conceptually at least, and economically. So if they did come out with a new iPhone SE, which I believe it was planned at some point, but was dropped for some reason because of some identifiers I've seen. But I think it would be an iPhone with the same body as the current SE, but with the internals of the iPhone 7 or 8, something like that.
So really focusing on the low-cost aspect, because the iPhone SE, I think Apple even admitted that it was more successful than they thought. And one reason for that also, I guess, was that it was selling into different kind of markets or different segments of the market, where some people bought it just because it was a smaller phone, and so, or they liked that, like, iPhone 5 style form factor, and some people bought it because it was the cheapest one. So that could also kind of play in here, where, you know, it's interesting to see where Apple will take the iPhone SE. Will they, you know, really double down on the low cost aspect, or will they just focus on the smaller aspect?
Yeah, and there's been a rumor about iOS 13 support for the devices, and I believe it was rumored that it wouldn't support the iPhone SE. So what I think about this is that if this is true and iOS 13 in fact does not support the iPhone SE, to me, that would be a sign that Apple wants to stop supporting that screen size.
Right,
and
exactly.
To be honest, I kind of wish that's true, because I don't want to support that screen size anymore, because it's kind of a pain.
Yeah, especially as we've moved to the iPhone X being like the smallest device in the current lineup. Like, if you not think about like the iPhone 8 and the ones that are, they're still selling them, but they're not like part of the main lineup. the designs that you have to make for the iPhone SE and for the iPhone X are hugely different, right? And that's why you see so many layout issues on these smaller devices. And it can be really, really tricky to get that right, especially if you want to make something like, let's take a login screen as an example. You usually don't want your login screen to have for the user to have to scroll. Like, you don't want to have to scroll to reach like the login button. You want all of that to be on the same screen. But if you need to display some text there, maybe you have like, you know, you have to agree to these terms and conditions or something. Like, you might have so many different components to that screen, and fitting all of those into an iPhone SE while still looking good on an iPhone X and XS Max can be really challenging.
Yeah, I've had some issues supporting that screen size for Chibi Studio. It's just because you have to support the iPhone XS Max, and it gives you so much space to work with, and it you can create some pretty complicated user interfaces that way. But then you have to compromise for the smaller device, and not all developers or companies have the resources to like do a fully custom design for the big or the small device. And what ends up happening is that those smaller devices end up holding back what could be done for the bigger devices, because people don't want to have to be doing these, if this device is smaller than X, then change this button or whatever. So you end up with the lowest common denominator.
Yeah, exactly. Not everyone wants to spend 50 hours on an animation, right? So yeah, it totally makes sense. And it is really tricky, especially if you're under time constraints, to create something that looks great on all devices. So another thing that Mark has shown, this is a tweet from Mark Erman. And here we're looking at what looks like some kind of case moldings for the new iPhones. And they show what has been long rumored, which is that there will be a new kind of camera housing on the device, which looks like it will be way bigger. Like, the little camera bump is growing up. It's going from a little bump to a big thing. And there's going to be presumably like three cameras on the high-end models and two cameras on the XR, or the successor to the XR. So what do you think about this picture, Rambo? And do you think this is something credible? Do you think this is something we'll see? It's not the first time we're hearing about it, so that's why it feels like something that could actually end up happening.
This is the type of leak or rumor that I don't really pay much attention to. I pay attention to what's said in Mark's reports, of course, because they are usually very accurate. And they inform my spelunking later. So if I know that the devices this year are supposed, some of them are supposed to have three cameras, so I can look for evidence of that when iOS 13 comes out and they release, accidentally leave some code in there for the new devices and stuff like that.
Right, like device.cameras.count returns three.
Yeah, if only it was that simple.
Right.
But the these like molds and parts and here's a picture from the factory, which is usually super blurry and dark, I don't really pay much attention to them because they are very often fake. I'm not saying it's the case here, but they can be, they often are. And I mean, there's not much I can learn from that. Like, it's a mold for a thing. So yeah, I really don't pay much attention to those things.
Right.
I always have a look, but yeah, not paying much attention to that stuff.
Yeah, and especially if they end up being fake, it can also be sometimes where, you know, if there's a rumor about something would look like this, then you could create a fake version of it and everyone will believe it because, you know, like I was saying before, like, this is not the first time we've heard about this. So it's kind of, you know, becoming this like self-fulfilling prophecy, if you will, or, you know, it's like it can be just something that plays into what was rumored before.
Yeah, and people make these amazing, like, realistic renders, which are quite remarkable. So that's kind of cool. But the problem I have with these fake leaks, and again, I'm not saying this is one of them, I'm just talking about the subject in general, is that they end up devaluing my work, because
right,
I am accused of being of having a fake thing when I am like I have never faked any of my stuff. I might be wrong sometimes with my assumptions of things, but I never deliberately fake anything. When we released the pictures of the iPhone XS Max and XS and the Apple Watch Series 4, there were people claiming that they were fake and that they right. had made them and sent them to me. So yeah, that's why I don't like when people spread fake rumors and pictures and stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And also knowing you and knowing your process, and you know, you are sometimes letting me in your process a little bit and showing me what you're doing and stuff like that under the hood. And I can tell you that you are definitely not just releasing something willy-nilly, right? You are really taking your time. You're doing very thorough research. And that's, I think, what a lot of people appreciate about your reports, because everyone knows that when you report on something, sure, you can get things wrong, right? And sometimes Apple changed their mind, and sometimes a product gets postponed or not released at all. But you can usually trust what you're saying because you have done your research.
Yeah, exactly. The last thing I want to do is to have to update a post with like fake at the end of the title.
Right, exactly. Yeah, you don't want that. So regardless if this is going to end up being fake or not, it's still interesting to discuss this kind of way of building the camera, you know, if this is going to indeed be the way the camera looks like. Like going from, like I said, a little bump until a bigger bump, and now we have this huge thing, presumably. So do you think this is a good move? Like, it feels like almost the camera is like eating the phone, you know? Like at some point, there's not going to be a phone anymore. It's just going to be a camera. And I understand that some of it has to do with optics. Like if you want to make a better camera, at some point, you know, computational photography, you can only take it so far. You also need like optics, and you need light to get in there into the sensor, and you need different sensors for different circumstances. But do you think, like, in general, this is a good direction for Apple to head in to kind of a little bit sacrifice the simplicity of the look of the device in order to be able to make the camera better?
The overwhelming reaction I've heard from people, from close friends and family and people, like regular, quote-unquote regular people reacting right. to the renders is, oh my God, that's ugly.
Yeah.
And I kind of agree, but I think the renders and molds and everything we've seen, I think they kind of make it look bigger than it will actually be in reality. Mm-hmm. If you look at the back of an iPhone X or an iPhone XS, XS Max, etc., and you imagine the current bump, and you imagine like the same bump again copied and pasted beside it, it's not that big, but it looks a lot bigger in the renders. So I think we can pretty much say that yes, it is going to be like that, but I think in reality it's not gonna be that big a deal. And I do agree that it's worth it if it has some significant gain in picture quality or features.
Yeah, exactly. I've also been thinking along the lines of, you know, if you make the camera more, like, you make it bigger, you make it more prominent on the device itself, it could also kind of be a way to market the device. Like, look at this device, it has this huge camera that is amazing, it's so good, and, you know, the camera really is, like, front and center on the device. And especially, like you say, the renders we're taking a look at here, which they're just like one solid color. It doesn't do justice, like you're saying. And once you get like the different parts and they have different colors and they are fully like, you know, designed and everything, it could look really cool. And it could definitely also be a way of saying, you know, look how cool the camera is, and that's why we made it so prominent.
That's true. And the thing you said about the camera bump being a marketing feature is totally true. And like for me, I love the camera on the new iPad Pro. It's so big, but it's beautiful in a way. Like it looks professional. Look at this right, yeah. huge lens I have on my camera. And even the iPhone XR, it has like quite a big lens on the back, and it looks great in my opinion. And we talked about before how with each new release, they kind of need something different on the outside of the device so that people who buy the new device just because it's new can say that they have the new device and people will notice that they have the new device.
Right.
It's kind of silly, but it is true. That
it's definitely a thing.
Yeah, many people, like, it's a status symbol. They want to, they want other people to notice that they have the new device.
Right.
And for that to be the case, there has to be something different about the exterior of the device. And the current form factor is quite good, so they are probably not going to change it this year, like the overall body of the device. So they have to do something else, and they can do it with like colors, or they can do it by changing the shape of the camera bump.
Yeah, exactly. And it does seem like Apple in general, they are kind of stretching out the lifespan of each form factor, similar a little bit to how it's been on the Mac for a long time, where the life cycle of each design, it's much longer, because presumably also there goes a lot of time and money and R&D and stuff into building the actual casing and the actual industrial design. And it kind of makes sense to try to reuse that for as long as possible without it becoming boring or without the technology kind of, you know, requiring a different form factor.
Yes, and we mentioned this before. I don't want my phone to change completely every year.
Right.
I'm one of those people who buys, always gets the new device. And I'm not one of those that who cares about whether it's the same or not in the exterior. But there are some people who are like, oh, Apple doesn't change the iPhone anymore. It's so boring. But I kind of want boring.
Right. Boring is good.
Yeah, in this sense, boring is good because, yeah, I don't want the device I use mostly like every single day to every year change completely. Of course, I'm not required to buy the new device if I don't like it. But I like the small incremental iterations that improve the device, and I can keep using the same knowledge I've had from the previous device.
Yeah, and you can also reuse things like cases if you would use a case. You can, like sometimes you have docks and things like that. And, you know, when they change things like connectors, then people really go crazy. but it definitely has a lot of practical value for the same case to be used. And it's also a little bit like, if it's not broken, don't fix it, right? Like, I really love the iPhone X style body of the device. And, you know, if they can make changes and improvements to the actual phone and add new features without necessarily changing the actual size and dimensions and things like that, then yeah, why not?
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So really exciting to see. And it's going to be interesting to see what's going to happen next in the saga of scoops with you and with German and with everyone else involved. But for now, let's move on and let's do one of our favorite segments, which is, of course, Ask Stacktrace. So again, big thanks to everyone who is sending us questions on Twitter. You can tweet with the hashtag AskStacktrace. And we really love to see this because it gives us some great feedback to see what you are interested in and you want us to talk about. And it's also fun to answer questions that people have actually asked as well. So we're going to kick it off with a question from Kayo. And Kayo wants to know, how do we clean our MacBook keyboards and trackpad? So do we have some cleaning tips here, Rambo? How is a good, thorough Rambo clean going on? Do you take your MacBook Pro to the shower, maybe?
No, that would be kind of crazy. So as we mentioned on our Italy episode, you noticed that my Mac is quite clean.
Very clean. It looked like it just came out of the box.
Yeah, so I am... First of all, I'm careful. I don't eat on top of my keyboard for obvious reasons, especially with the latest generation keyboards.
Yeah.
And I don't like put my finger on the screen. It's not a touch screen. It kind of drives me nuts when someone else touches my Mac's screen. So yeah, just basic care, being careful with it. I always close the lid when I'm not using the computer, because that will prevent dust and stuff from sticking to the screen and the keyboard. That's also a good tip. So that's like preventive care.
Right.
And so for cleaning, what I do is I use compressed air. I buy cans of compressed air and just remove all of the dust using compressed air on the screen, and mainly the keyboard, especially the keyboard. After that, I use a microfiber cloth with isopropyl alcohol. You can buy at electronic stores. And I use a cool little utility app called Keyboard Clean Tool. Very well named. So
yeah.
you launch this app and it locks your keyboard, so you can clean your device without having to turn it off.
Oh, that's very smart.
Exactly. And since I clean it quite frequently, it would be a pain to have to turn it off to clean it. So I use this keyboard clean tool. I do this process like once every other day or so. Or if,
whoa,
I feel
really?
Like... Yeah.
Wow. Oh, you're making me sound like a dirty person here. Like, I clean my Mac maybe like, I think I've had this one now for almost 2 years, and I think I've cleaned it twice. It gets its yearly Christmas bath. That's what my Mac does.
Yeah, so, yeah, because, like, my fingers are greasy, naturally. I think everyone's fingers are, at some extent, naturally greasy. And if I feel like my fingers are kind of sliding on my keyboard, it kind of, I'm like, ugh, no, I can't handle that. So I clean it pretty much every other day. But I don't clean the screen every other day. The screen, I only clean when, like, I notice there are some smudges or something. It's mostly the keyboard. And not just the keyboard, basically the top case. So, yeah, I use a microfiber cloth with isopropyl alcohol, and that's it. And for the screen, I just use the microfiber cloth. I only use that. No products, no nothing, just the cloth.
Cool. So if you want to take cleaning advice for your Apple devices, you should probably just listen to Rambo. I don't have much to add here. Mine is just like I wipe it off with some paper or something every once in a while, like an animal. When I see it's dirty, I will just wipe it off. And my iPad, I do clean more. I have like a special cleaning cloth that I keep in my little bag for the iPad, and I will just wipe that because that does get greasy. Picks up fingerprints, of course, because you're touching the screen. But the Mac, you know, I keep my Mac in a clamshell mode like 90% of the time. So I don't really feel like I need to clean it a lot. And, you know, I also tend to treat my products and my technology devices a little bit more like, you know, appliances. Like, I don't need them to be these like pristine items that are super clean. I can just use them, and if they get a little bit dirty as I'm using them, well, that's just cost of doing business. So I'm fine with that. As long as I can see the screen, it's good.
that's like therapy.
You should probably make a note to yourself now to never lend any of your Apple devices to me, because I will treat them with care. I'm very careful. I will say that, very careful. But I definitely don't clean them every second day. Like, for me, that sounds like insanity.
Yeah. One important distinction is that I actually use the notebook as a notebook. Many people don't. Like, you use it in clamshell mode. I'm sure if I was using it like that, I wouldn't be cleaning it as often, because it wouldn't get as dirty, of course. So yeah, if you're not using the laptop as a laptop very often, then yeah, you don't have to clean it as often.
Right. Cool. So our next question comes from Saulo. And Saulo wants to hear if we are excited about any new features that might be coming to Xcode. So with all of the leaks and new reports and things like that we've had around iOS 13 and UIKit apps on the Mac, Rambo, do you have any scoops or anything else that we can know what to expect from WWDC in terms of Xcode features?
Well, besides the marzipan checkbox, which is going to be fun, I don't really know much about Xcode. That's like something that's kept secret very well because, it's just Xcode. So basically just the Xcode team is working on it and then people inside Apple can use it. So it's very rare for Xcode specific stuff to leak. What I do know, what I have heard is that the result of the BuddyBuild acquisition is not going to appear this year. It's going to be a 2020 thing.
All right. Yeah, that would make sense because depending on what route they go down with the BuddyBuild stuff, with like continuous integration and build service and things like that, like it could be a massive undertaking, right? And it could be something where, you know, let's say just for the sake of argument that Apple would say that everyone with an Apple developer account will get some kind of continuous integration within their account for free or included in their price. Well, they have like 10 million registered developers, right? So imagine like 10 million developers like going and starting building their apps. And as we know, apps these days, they can take quite a long time to build. So that could be huge in terms of just like needing to scale that and things like that. So that would make sense to me also that it would take a bit longer for that to get ready.
Or they could just charge for the service and increase their services revenue.
Yeah, perfect, right? Yeah.
BuddyBuild Plus.
Exactly. So let's go down like just a list of features that we have been expecting for a while and that could be, you know, potential candidates for this year's WWDC. So from my perspective, Swift Package Manager support in Xcode is a big one. Yep. I know it's still kind of a little bit of a edge case, if you will. Like, I feel like there's not that many people using the Swift Package Manager if you compare it to the amount of people who are using, you know, Xcode in general. So I will understand like why that has still not happened and why that could potentially be something that they down prioritize because they have bigger fish to fry. But it would be awesome to see, and especially as Swift on the server is taking off, and I personally love the Swift Package Manager, and I would love for it to be more integrated into Xcode. And still, like, right now you can generate an Xcode project from a Swift package. You can do it on the command line, but it's very clear that it's not tightly integrated. And, you know, there's so many kind of, there's this glue that is missing where it feels like Xcode and Swift Package Manager are two completely separate worlds and they are designed under different circumstances and they have different views of what a project is. And it would be great if we could just like normalize that a little bit to be more streamlined. And it would be great if we could use like a package.swift file, like a package definition file where you can define your dependencies and your targets and your products. It would be really great if we could use that for iOS, if you could use that for all kinds of Xcode projects, because that means that we could say goodbye to our Xcode project files, which I think would make a lot of people very happy.
Yeah, that would be very, very good. This is something I talked about previously. What I would really like is anything that improves iteration times when you're working on something, especially UI. I know there's Interface Builder, but it's not really live. So you're seeing like a preview of what your UI will kind of look like. I would love to have some sort of live reloading feature for when I'm building like a complicated UI, either in code or even in IB, that I could actually see it running on device live without having to build a run, which it's kind of boring.
Yeah, that would be really amazing. And that also kind of feels a little bit tied to what we talked about last week, which is about like the declarative new UI framework. Like if you go declarative and you create your UI more from these standalone components that can just be mixed and matched together, doing something like that becomes orders of magnitude simpler, where you can have an observer in the IDE, like in Xcode, to see whenever a component was changed, and then you could just re-render those components. I feel like with the current setup, maybe the new build system, LLBuild, which was introduced as a beta 2 years ago and as the standard build system last year, I feel like that's a step in the right direction, where the build is becoming more modular and more like split up into different parts. That could also enable some kind of hot reloading or live editing features. But I feel like there's a lot of pieces that need to fall into place in order to for that to be really feasible.
Yeah, I think as an intermediate, they could work on having a way for you to refresh your app on device without having to go through the regular iOS app install cycle. Because right now, every time you build and run from Xcode, your app has to be reinstalled on the device. And that's usually fairly quick, but it's when you are iterating on something, when you're working on that transition, which took 50 hours, it kind of sucks to have to wait for the whole app install cycle to happen. And if you have a watch app, it's going to reinstall your entire watch app as well. So, yeah, it would be really cool to be able to maybe have a different mode to run the app on device that doesn't require the entire installation to happen.
Yeah, what would be really cool is if the build process, like the compilation of the app, could kind of just generate a delta and say, here is the difference from the previous binary and the new binary, and then just like hot patch that into the app that is running. And just say like, here is this new piece, just replace that with what you previously had, and then just keep going. But I feel like that's a pretty big change, and it would also require like some really sophisticated runtime features, because as we know, like Swift and Objective-C, the languages we use, Objective-C is more dynamic, but Swift is very static and relies a lot on modules and things being cross-checked between modules and things like that. So it would be tricky, I think, to get that into the runtime, but if they could, that could be really, really huge.
Yeah, or even like if I'm working on a view controller that's in a framework, just send that framework over to the device and instantiate the view controller and put it on screen.
Yeah, absolutely.
Reload just the framework. Yeah, I think there's stuff that could be done there, but like you said, I'm not sure. Maybe they'll wait for the whole Ember thing to work until they do this. But I hope they do eventually.
Yeah, me too. And like always, like it would be great to see like better stability in Xcode, better integration with things like SourceKit and the rest of the Swift open source toolchain. There's also the Language Server Protocol, which is a project from Microsoft originally, which the Swift team has committed to supporting. And what that could mean is that if Xcode would start using that as a first-class citizen, it would mean that you could use Swift in whatever editor you want that supports this protocol, which is most of the major editors. And that way you could get like syntax highlighting, you could get autocomplete and things in whichever editor you want, the same way you get it in Xcode, which would be a really big step.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, so really exciting to see what's going to happen at WWDC. And like you mentioned, Rambo, the Xcode features and the developer tools are usually very well-kept secrets. So it's going to be especially interesting to see what's new in all of that space. And hopefully that's something that I'll be able to cover in great detail on my WWDC site, and we'll of course talk a lot about it on this show as well. So please keep sending us questions. Again, you can tweet with the hashtag AskStackTrace, and we'll pick up your question on a future episode. But for now, that's it. We've reached the end of this one, and we'll be back again next week. Until then, you can find us on Twitter. I am at John Sundell. Mr. Rambo is at _inside. You can head over to 9to5Mac.com to find the show notes for this episode. You can find all of Rambo's great articles there, and you can head over to swiftbysundell.com to find my articles. But that's it for this episode, so thank you so much for listening, everybody, and say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.